So the conductor is 0 if the curve is non-singular, the exponent is 0. The exponent is 1 if it's multiplicative reduction, which means that, and you can translate this into something purely algebraic, the graph looks like that. That is to say, the singular point, when you reduce, is a node. And the other possibility is 2 if you have, it's called additive reduction. Looks like that. Now, the things are a little bit more subtle when p is 2 or 3, and I won't describe exactly how the conductor is determined in those cases. So it's a number that measures the primes of bad reduction for the curve, and the important fact is that for each conductor, there are only finitely many elliptic curves with that conductor, up to isomorphism. So if you look at the book that's hopefully being handed around, you'll see that you can look up any conductor, and you'll see a list of all the curves with that conductor. And this list is provably complete. The fact it's provably complete is an extremely deep theorem. But it is complete in each case for each conductor. Another alternative way to think about the conductor, which I mentioned, is the following. For each positive integer n, there's a curve x naught of n, which as a Riemann surface is the upper half plane modulo the action of gamma naught of n via linear fractional transformations, where gamma naught of n, this is the set of matrices A, B, C, D with determinant 1 integer entries. And their upper triangular modulo n. This is a subgroup of SL2z that acts on the upper half plane. The quotient is x naught of n, and a curve has conductor n if and only if that's the minimal n, so you have a surjective morphism of curves like this. So the conductor is the minimal n, such that you have a modular parametrization like this. In fact, you have any parametrization like this at all, that I mean, think about it this way. If you have an elliptic curve, what I'm saying is that there's a map from the upper half plane to the elliptic curve that factors through the action of gamma naught of n. This is very similar to what you have when you think of an elliptic curve as the complex numbers modulo a lattice. You take the C points of any elliptic curve at all, that's C modulo a lattice, a torus. And here what you have is that there's a surjective map from C down to here, and it's invariant under the action of z, under an action of z plus z. So it factors through the quotient of c by some translation action. Here it's the same thing, it's just that, so you have a map from, instead of the complex numbers, you have a map from h star, and it factors through the action of gamma naught of n. That is to say, the image of two points is the same if one gets sent to the other by some element of gamma naught of n. So you could say that this E being a quotient of x naught of n means that E is uniformized. It's expressed in a way kind of like this, except where the C is replaced by the upper half plane. And the group Z plus Z, the translations by elements in the lattice, that's replaced by a subgroup of SL2Z. The modularity theorem that Wiles proved to prove Fermat's last theorem was the statement that every elliptic curve can be uniformized in this way. I slightly lie, he only proved it. To prove Fermat, you just have to prove that for curves with multiplicative reduction at all bad primes. That's all. He needed only that special case. But a lot of work subsequently proved it in general. So that's a little background on the conductor. But the thing is, if you fix a conductor, then there's just a finite list of curves that can possibly be quotients like this. And they're purely algebraic techniques that allow you to find all of them. In fact, they just involve a bunch of linear algebra in this part. Actually, I'll do a very quick aside on that. You take this curve, this is an algebraic curve, or a Riemann surface if you take its complex points. And I don't know if anyone who knows about integral homology of Riemann surfaces or topological spaces, but if you do, you'll know that this is a free abelian group of rank 2g. And this free abelian group of rank 2G also has a structure of a module over a certain ring, which is called T, and or just denoted T, and it's called the Hecke algebra. And one can explicitly compute this as a module over T. And if you find the common, this is a commutative ring, so if you find the common eigenspaces in the simple modules, or what's the same in simple modules, essentially, then the ones of dimension 1 correspond to the elliptic curves. So by doing linear algebra with a certain module that you can view as a homology group, you can compute all the elliptic curves of a given conductor. And doing that is what most of this book is about. So the first half of the book is about how to do that, and the second half is about the curves that you actually get. Okay, so on to the thing. So here's the slide that you've seen before, just a reminder of what an elliptic curve is. So remember, this one's not an elliptic curve. This was a cubic, a genus 1 curve, or it defines a genus 1 curve, but it doesn't have any rational points over Q. So it's not an elliptic curve. And we had Mordell's theorem, which we in fact proved that. So Mordell only proved this over the rational numbers. He said if you have an elliptic curve over Q, then E of Q is Z to the R plus torsion. And they generalized this and proved it over number fields and also for abelian varieties, which are higher dimensional analogs of elliptic curves. So you also hopefully remember the L function of an elliptic curve. So it's a product for, is a function that's defined on some right half plane as a product 1 over 1 minus AP P to the minus S plus P times P to the minus 2S, and then there's a recipe for the local factor of each prime of bad reduction, and that involved the inertia invariance of some Galois representation. But you can make it completely explicit. And these A sub P is just P plus 1 minus the number of planes. So if you plug in some S that's, you know, some large positive integer, you see that this will converge very nicely, because if S is a large positive integer, this is very small, that's very, very small, so you get something that's very close to 1, and as P goes to infinity, very quickly, each individual factor very quickly converges to 1. So you get some function, that function is holomorphic because these AP aren't too big, and because P to the minus S is, and so you have a holomorphic function on a right half plane that you get out of this. But then the fact that the elliptic curve is a quotient of x and out of n allows you to prove that this thing analytically continues to the whole complex plane. So that's the L function. So it's a function that over here, this is the complex plane over here, it's given by this formula, product of 1 over 1 minus AP P to the minus S plus P times P to the minus 2S times some other bad factors. And it is a theorem that it continues to a function that's defined over here. So it's mysterious, but it's defined uniquely over here. And this is by, well, this is defined because the elliptic curve is modular. By the way, the conference I went to in Bristol last week, we were trying to. So somebody has a this guy Brian Connery has a conjecture, which says if you have a function that's given by what's called an Euler product like this, and one additional thing is satisfied, namely it has a functional equation. That is, there's a very simple formula that relates the value of the function at S to the value of the function at 2 minus S, and that is the case for elliptic curve L functions. Once you know they come from modular forms. If you have those two conditions, then what we were trying to prove is that you can automatically, analytically continue it. Not just for an elliptic curve L function, but for anything. We failed miserably, but it's an interesting conference. There's a theorem of Vey which says that if you have an L function and it has this functional equation, that is, a simple formula relates the value at s to the value at 2 minus s, then if that's true, and the L function of each twist, where a twist is something like, you define the same thing, but you replace AP by AP times chi of P, where chi is a Dirichlet character, if all of those also have a functional equation, then the thing comes from a modular form, and hence you can analytically continue. So it's called Vey's converse theorem. But the theorem that we were working on at Bristol was to try to replace the requirement of having a functional equation for all of the twists of the L function by having an Euler product. So just in case you're curious. But for elliptic curves, none of that's necessary since we know that all elliptic curves come from modular forms, and once they come from modular forms, this L function analytically continues no problem. Alright, so I showed you this before. It's the graph of the real points of the L series of an elliptic curve of rank 1. So by that I mean I'm taking the L function and evaluating on the real line and its real value, and there's a graph just like in calculus classes. This is a graph along the same range of x values, but I'm including some imaginary values, and it's this color graph where black is low in absolute value, and the lighter colors is higher. So it still sort of goes down, down, and up at the end. So if you look at the previous graph, notice that 0 at s equal to 1 and 0 at 0 at minus 1 actually does go through 0 at minus 2. It's 0 at all the negative integers. But it kind of gets big in absolute value down there, and you see the same thing in this graph. It's big in absolute value right around here. It gets really big up here. And there's a 0 at s equal to 1 here, right there. So this is the million-dollar Clay Math Institute prize problem. And that's that the order vanishing at s equal to 1 of the L function is equal to the rank of the Myrtle Day group. So we have this conjecture. We don't know it in general, but it is a theorem when the order vanishing is 0 or 1. But in no other case is it a theorem, except in particular examples. So the theorem, this is a theorem of Colley-Weigand. And this is true if the order of vanishing is less than or equal to 1. So this conjecture for elliptic curves over Q, that's the Clay math problem. There's also a conjecture for elliptic curves over number fields, but so you can still define the L function over a number field, but we don't know that it analytically continues. It's very difficult for any other fields besides Q. The definition is just about the same. In fact, it is the same. Right? But you don't have you don't really know any modularity theorems for elliptic curves over other fields. There are some special cases, but it's not nearly as good of a situation. But in general, one conjectures this, not just over Q, but for elliptic curves over number fields, and also for abelian varieties. But maybe I should stop saying abelian variety. Does anyone here have any idea what an abelian variety is? Okay, so an elliptic curve is a genus 1 curve equipped with a group structure, and which means you have a rational point in a group operation. Okay? An abelian variety is a variety which has a group structure and is projective. That's it. It's any projective variety with a group structure. By group structure, I mean you have a map from the variety cross itself to the variety, and you have an inverse, and you have an identity element. So an abelian variety is simply, you take the definition of an elliptic curve, and you just, instead of saying dimension 1 having a group structure and projective, you say arbitrary dimension has a group structure and is projective. And projective means it's a closed subset of projective space. So it's complete or compact. So that's what an abelian variety is. But you don't know what they are in the same sense that you know what elliptic curves are, because for an elliptic curve, you always have this very nice, simple equation that defines the thing. An abelian variety, even of fairly small dimension, it could take a huge number of equations to describe it, and sort of very complicated. Fortunately, there's a class of examples of abelian varieties, which are kind of natural dimension once you write down a curve like this. If you take any curve There's something called its Jacobian. So here X is an algebraic curve. It should be non-singular. So you just give, say, a single equation, and it's the zero locus of that equation, and assume it doesn't have any singular points. Or more generally, you could take a couple of equations intersecting in a couple of equations intersecting in three-dimensional space. The Jacobian is the group of degree zero divisors on the curve, much of the linear equivalence, i.e., what I called before, pick zero of x, as a group. I only define this as a group. Remember, this was degree zero divisors, modulo divisors of functions. But this is a group, and I claim this is, in fact, a variety with a group structure. And it's a non-trivial theorem that this group, the group of degree zero divisors modulo linear equivalence, is in a very natural way the group of points on a variety. And here's another amazing theorem. Any abelian variety at all is a quotient of one of these. So if you consider the Jacobians of curves and then take a quotient out by, just take maps, surjective homomorphisms from them to other varieties, you'll get all the abelian varieties over a number of fields. So you can think of abelian varieties as Jacobians of curves and quotients of Jacobians of curves. So fortunately, curves you can usually describe pretty simply. You just say the curve is the zero locus of some, you know, equation, like x to the n plus y to the n equals z to the n. That describes a curve, a projective curve. So you can describe Jacobians of curves pretty easily, and often you can also describe a quotient. So you can describe, in general, abelian varieties this way, very simply, without actually giving the equations for the abelian varieties. Here, this is just the theorem I stated before, that this statement is true if the order of vanishing is less than or equal to 1. If you can prove this for order of vanishing 2, then you will be very, very famous. So it's people are very stuck on the case of order of vanishing 2 or higher. You have an elliptic curve. Here's an example. I don't remember the equation, but it's in the book. So the first curve in order of vanishing 2 is this one right here, y squared plus y equals x cubed plus x minus 2. So this is a curve with conductor prime number 389, and the order of vanishing of its L function at the point 1 is equal to 2. And if you look in this book, you'll find two independent generators. And in fact, you know that the rank in this particular case is 2. But there's somehow no explanation of where those two generators come from. The interesting thing here is in this theorem of Kalevagin, here's Kalevagin, and Gross and Zagier, is that there's a very nice natural interpretation of where the point comes from. If the order of vanishing is equal to 1, the point arises in a very natural way. There's a nice construction of it. And if the order of vanishing is 0, you don't have to explain the point because you're saying there aren't any. The natural way in which the point arises comes from this picture. So really this theorem, I write Kalevagin here, but it also requires Weyl's and so on, in order to know that your curve is a quotient of x, not of n. But this curve, which is the upper half-plane mod gamma not of n, well, you can think of lots of points on it. In fact, give me any complex number in the upper half-plane, and that certainly gives you an element of this collection of orbits. That gives you an element of this curve, and then you could take its image via this modular parameterization, you get a point on the elliptic curve. So it's somehow easy to magic up lots of points on the elliptic curve. The problem, of course, you could do exactly what I just said. You could take your elliptic curve and view it as C modulo lambda. For any complex number, you get a point here, and then you can map that over to your elliptic curve. But you don't get anything interesting because most points that you choose here will just map to random complex value, you know, points with complex entries. But over here, there is something more that you can do. If you choose your point in the upper half plane to actually to also lie in a quadratic imaginary field, then you can control very precisely the field of definition of the image of that point down here. And the resulting points that you get are called Huebner points, because Huebner studied them and sort of introduced them to mathematics. And again, Huebner, he was this high school teacher in Germany who was the first to prove, to solve Gauss's class number one problem. And he solved it using methods that involved these Huebner points. Nobody took him seriously until long after he died. So that's what we know. But here, unfortunately, so they're two simple generators, but there's no interpretation for them as, say, images of points like this or something similar. And if in even one case you could find an interpretation for points on a rank 2 elliptic curve, that would be, even conjectural interpretation, that would be more than anyone knows right now, as far as I can tell. Do you have any comments or questions? Okay, moving forward. If you take an elliptic curve, you can ask, what about the Taylor expansion of the L function about s equal to 1? So it seems that the point s equal to 1 is a very important point arithmetically for the L function of an elliptic curve. By the way, one reason you might expect 1 to be important is that there's a symmetry that I mentioned before that relates L E S to L E 2 minus S, and the center, so the critical strip here, just like for the Riemann zeta function, you have a critical strip, but for an L function of an elliptic curve, it's from 0 to 2, and the central line is S equal to 1, where the symmetry relates the value of the function to itself. So this is somehow the special thing to look at. And there's a 0 right here, maybe. If there's a 0, then you expect the curve to have infinite, many rational points, otherwise only finitely many. And by the way, there's a Riemann hypothesis which says that all the non-trivial zeros of this function, so you have zeros at the negative integers, as you can see in, say, the graph over there, but the non-trivial zeros are all supposed to lie on this line, real part of s equals 1/2. And another interesting thing about the Bristol conference I went to is that there's a guy, Michael Rubinstein, who was at the conference, and he was a student of Peter Sarnak at Princeton, and what he's spent a lot of his life doing is choosing specific elliptic curves and then enumerating all the zeros of their L functions along this line. And you know, you have something, you see something similar to the Riemann hypothesis where you have lots and lots of them, and they all do, in fact, in practice, when he computes, lie on the line real part of S equals 1, as expected. It seems, when you look at the data, they're a lot denser than the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. So zeta, the first one for zeta, say at 14 or something, but for elliptic curve L functions, they're usually a bit lower. As far as I can tell, they seem to be closer together. Yes?
Do we know the Riemann hypothesis for curves?
Only over finite fields.
Okay, so...
Curves over finite fields, or function fields over finite fields. We don't know the Riemann hypothesis for curves over number fields. It's basically like the usual Riemann hypothesis, but a lot harder. So, yeah. We do know, so, Deline and others proved very nice Riemann hypothesis results, but over function fields. But, yeah, this is really very, very similar to just the zeta function over Q. So what about the Taylor series? So if S equal to 1 is such a special point, maybe if you take the L function and consider its Taylor series about S equal to 1, you might see something interesting. So it's C0 plus C1 times S minus 1 plus C2 times S minus 1 squared. And you have a Taylor series because L is a holomorphic function. The definition of holomorphic function, or a definition of holomorphic function, is that at each point locally, the function is given by a power series with complex number of coefficients. So it's just locally, it converges to its Taylor expansion. That's a definition of holomorphic. So Here's an example of the beginning of a Taylor series computed numerically for an elliptic for the elliptic curve of rank 1 in conductor 37. So the L function vanishes at 1, but it doesn't, its derivative doesn't vanish. So if you plug in s equal to 1 here, you get 0. You get that. But its derivative, it's 0.3059997, etc. Then you click at the next term of the Taylor expansion, and it's 0.18636, etc. And so on, you have this long Taylor expansion. So the question is there any meaning to the coefficients in this Taylor expansion? So, first, there's the Bertrand-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture, which I mentioned to you before and said some things about. We did an example, but I didn't really define some of the quantities that appear in it. And it says the first non-zero term should have its subscript exactly the same as the rank of the elliptic curve, and it is this number, which you get by combining together all the invariants that you know for an elliptic curve. So that's what the Bertrand-Swinnerton-Dyer formula says. So I'll tell you a little more about each of the invariants that I haven't, that aren't sort of obvious from what I've told you so far. But by the way, if you look at, say, I'm going to come back to this slide in a second. If you look at the next coefficient of the Taylor expansion about s equal to 1, nobody has any interpretation at all of that coefficient. So, you know, in this case, the coefficient corresponding to the rank, you have this really nice formula that conjecturally gives it to you. The next coefficient is just completely mysterious, and nobody has even a wild and crazy guess as to what it means. Maybe it doesn't mean anything, but I tried to think of something, couldn't think of anything. I asked people like Mazur, and I said, he said something about it not being a period, so you shouldn't expect any interpretation. But, you know, pessimism like that isn't always the right way to go. But maybe there isn't a nice interpretation of any of the other coefficients. Yes?
You said that the conjecture itself has been verified for rank less than or equal to 1.
Yeah, only the rank part of the conjecture, though, not the formula.
Okay.
The formula is actually not, I mean, formula, some special, there are some results towards the formula that are known for rank less than or equal to 1, but the formula exactly as stated is not known for rank less than or equal to 1. And probably if you knew the formula for rank less than or equal to 1, you could prove more about the rank conjecture for rank greater than 1, because there are various connections between the formula and the rank. Somewhat surprisingly. So the answer to your question is no, but there are results towards it. And I'll tell you more about that in a minute. Okay, so here's the slide where I have all these quantities that are supposed to be the coefficient here. And let's see what we already know about. So the torsion subgroup, what's that?
About
the torsion subgroup for elliptic curves over Q, at least if you believe big terms.
Q of Z mod n z for n 1 through 10 or 12, or it's Z mod 2 plus Z mod n z for n, I think 2, 4, 6, or 8.
Yep. Excellent. So that's the torsion subgroup. So in the denominator, you have the square of the order of the torsion subgroup. Let's see. The regulator. Do you have a sense of what the regulator is? Does anybody have any clue what that is?
Discriminant or something.
Okay, discriminant is something.
Related to the height.
That's right, related to the height.
Some logarithms involved.
Yeah, in defining the height.
I think it's the limit of the height.
True. Let's see if you're converging on the regulator. Does anybody know what the regulator is? An elliptic curve. Okay, so you take a collection of generators for the Mordell Weygroup modulo torsion, and then you create a matrix that is the pairings of those things with themselves, with, you know, all the pairings using the height pairing. So remember, you have heights, then you have this logarithmic height, and you make it canonical by taking a limit. So you take the limit h of 2 to the n times p over 4 to the n. You get a canonical height that doesn't depend on any weird choices, has nice properties, and you take the discriminant of the height pairing matrix, and that's the regulator, the absolute value of the discriminant of the height pairing matrix. Or U of Q modulo the torsion subgroup. And this pairing is the height pairing, so H of PQ, or actually, angle brackets PQ is H of, what's it, P? Is that right? That's right. Yeah. And this height is the limit n goes to infinity of a naive height 2 to the n p over 4 to the n. And then the naive height is the logarithm of the maximum of the numerator and the absolute value of the numerator and denominator of the x coordinate of the. So it's a measure of how big it's a measure of how big this group is. Just like the cardinality of the torsion subgroup is a measure of how big this is, this regulator is a very precise measure of how big E of Q is. But it's something better than just a number R. It's something that really depends on the specific thing. I think there's an open problem here too, which is consider all real numbers that are regulators of elliptic curves over Q that are, say, strictly bigger than 1, or just not equal to 1. Because if the rank is 0, then you just hit 1. So, say the rank, let's just take the case rank of A, E equals 1. So this is a collection of real numbers. What's the, is it bounded below by, I mean, does it have a minimum? Is the minimum attained? So it's a collection of real numbers. What can you say about it? So I don't think that's understood. So if you look at lots and lots of regulators, you get lots and lots of numbers. What are they? What's the minimum? These are quite small. So if you look at this book, it has a list of all the regulators for curves of conductor up to 1,000. And I mean, there are these numbers, but it might be that there's some minimum that occurs or doesn't occur. You can see the regulators listed in the last column if you look at the book. So there's probably a conjecture to be made there. So that's the regulator. Let's see what else. Omega E, that's the integral of the real points of the curve. So I mean, the definition isn't really how you compute it, but So you take, if your curve is given by a minimal equation y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, you integrate over the real points of the curve. That's right. So it's some very, you know, explicit interval, and you can compute it efficiently. Is that right, or did I get it? Okay. So that's just some number that you compute, and it just measures how big the real points on the elliptic curve are. So this is how big the torsion subgroup is. Regulator is how big the Wardell Bay group is. Omega E, that's how big the set of real points on the elliptic curve is. Tamagawa numbers. TP, I haven't defined those yet, but I'll define those for you now. And I'll give you a definition that really isn't so suitable for computing, but at least it's a definition.
sounds like all the numbers.
So say we have an elliptic curve E over Q and prime P.
Then here's what you can do. You can consider E of QP, which is the group of points on the elliptic curve over the p-adic numbers. And it's a map from here. Given a point in here, you can reduce it. You can try to reduce it modulo p. So I'll just write this. You have a reduction map from here to. You take your curve given by a minimal wire stress equation and reduce it modulo p. Now, maybe I shouldn't write it that way. I'll write it like this. I don't have landing points, so I'll write it like that. This is the curve reduced modulo p. And this need not be, in general, a non-singular curve. This could be singular. It could have singular points. In which case, you don't get a group here. You could have one singular point, actually. But if you take the subset of points in here that are non-singular, then you do get a group. So inside of here, let's take the subgroup of non-singular points. So in the case of multiplicative reduction, you get the multiplicative group, and in additive reduction, you get the additive group. So you get a group that's isomorphic, in this case, to Fp under addition, and in this case, to Fp star under multiplication. So you get a subgroup. Now if you take the inverse image of that subgroup, that's a subgroup of E of Qp. Which is called E0 Qp. So E0 Qp is just the stuff in E of Qp that has non-singular reduction. So you take all elements of E of Qp so that when you reduce them, they don't reduce to the singular point. And that forms a subgroup of E of QP. And it's a finite index subgroup. And the Tamagawa number is simply that index. That's what TP is. So first, is it clear from the definition that TP is equal to 1 for all the finitely many P, assuming that there are only finitely many terms of bad reduction, which is true. So, I mean, notice I have a product only over P dividing N, but what happens if p doesn't divide in? What's the Tamagawa number if p doesn't divide in? If p is a prime of good reduction. Yeah, you're right. It's 1. Why is it 1?
Because if it has good reduction, then all the points in modulo p are non-singular, so you get the entire subgroup.
Right. So there's no condition, so you get the whole thing. But in general, this is finite, and tp is the same.
Then of the non-singular points within, like, the well, I mean, I guess you can't really define an index because it's, because that might not be a group over.
Yeah, this isn't a group, and really this is only one point bigger than that.
So but it's not like the ratio between the sizes of those?
No, because this one has cardinality exactly one more than that one when you have bad reduction. So it's not the cardinality, not the ratio of the sizes. But there's an interpretation that is similar to what you're, I think, maybe thinking about, but it requires some additional ideas. You can choose somehow a better model for the elliptic curve, and then when you reduce it, you get something non-singular, but it's not a single equation. You have to have lots of equations, but you reduce that, you get something non-singular, but it's not connected anymore. And then the Tamagawa number is essentially the number of components, number of connected components. That's a different story altogether. And it's an equivalent formulation. There's also a Galois cohomology definition. This is also equal to H1, the cardinality of H1, QP unramified over QP, E of QP unramified. So here, this means the Galois group of the maximal unramified extension of QP over QP, and this is the group of points on it. And this is just the Galois cohomology we've been talking about so far. And it's there are several steps, and it's a highly, I'd say, a fairly non-trivial fact, but these two are the same. But I think if I had defined the Tamagawa number using this definition, we would be very unhappy compared to this definition. But they are, in fact, equal to that. It's a pretty non-trivial fact. It's true. So that's the Tamagawa number, and the only thing that remains on the slide that I haven't explained is the Shafrey-Rich Tate group. And I can define it now because you know a little bit of Galois cohomology. So, the definition of Shafrey-Rich Tate group of E over Q. So, that's what I'm defining. So, it's the following, it's denoted as letter. And it's the kernel of the map from H1QE. So remember, this came up in the proof of the weak Mordell Bay theorem. We had the exact sequence EPE multiplication by PE. Then we had the long exact sequence of Galois cohomology. And this would have, well, that would have been one of the terms if we had extended the sequence further. We only needed E of P, mod, I said P just a second ago, but I'll write in here, E of Q mod N E of Q into H1 Q E N. That's what we used in our proof, that you have an injection like this, then we sort of analyzed everything over here, but the next term in the sequence is H1 Q E, and then the next map is multiplication by n, so you can just put n and 0. So just, hopefully this is a somewhat familiar object to you. It's a very big object, I mean, it's, you know, like, E of Q bar, that's a really big group, right? Take the elliptic curve and take the Q bar points, that's huge. Hard to understand. This is also huge. So this has infinitely many, it's a torsion group, but it has infinitely many elements of all order. It's really, really big. But inside of it, there is a conjecturally very small little tiny group called the Shafrey-Rich Tate group that exactly measures the failure of being able to understand H1QE purely locally. So take the map to the direct sum over all primes P. When I say P less than infinity, I mean you also have to include, if P equals infinity, the completion is the real numbers. So you take H1QP E. So here, Q infinity, by that I mean real numbers. So it's the kernel of that map. Now, what on earth do I mean by that map? How do you get a map from here to there? So I will explain that. But this is the Shafrey-Rich Tate group. It's a measure of the failure of being able to understand an element here by simply looking at what it is locally everywhere. And by the way, these local Galois cohomology groups, you know, they probably seem they probably seem even worse to you than the global one. By the way, reminder, when I write H1QE, I mean group cohomology H1 Galois Q bar over Q, comma E of Q bar. And since this is infinite, by that I mean continuous co-cycles mod co-boundaries. Or I mean you take somehow a union over all finite Galois extensions of the usual group cohomology. But these probably look even worse to you than this, because if you replaced Q and its Galois group by the Galois group of QP, which might be, you might think it might be really, really complicated. In fact, it is pretty complicated. But trust me, these are a lot easier to deal with than this one. For example, this H1QP, there's a theorem of Tate which gives a pairing between H1QPE and E of QP. gives you a, that these are in Pontryagin duality, so it's very nice. This is generally, you know, like something like ZP, this is pretty close to being ZP as a group, and this is some torsion group, and we have this perfect pairing here. This is called Tate local duality. But the only reason I'm mentioning it is because it's supposed to emphasize to you that this isn't too complicated of a group if it's basically just a group of points on an elliptic curve up to some duality. Okay, so so how do you map H1QE to H1QPE for a given prime P? So you just have to understand how to do this for one prime, then you put together all the maps, and you get you get this map. So fix a prime P. Now we need a map from H1QE to H1QPE. And this map will just be res, where here this is, I'm writing it in terms of groups, this is H1 gal Q bar over Q, or like E, Q bar. And the other one is H1 gal QP bar over QP E. And there's a way to embed gal QP bar over QP in gal Q bar over Q. So if you, there's various ways of trying to explain this, but one way to make it plausible at least is to imagine that you fix yeah, so just imagine you fix a choice of an embedding of Q bar and QP bar. You can certainly do that because QP bar has characteristic zero. And Q sits inside of QP. So when you take the algebraic closure of Q bar, you could take it inside of QP bar. Right? So if you have an automorphism of QP bar over QP, then that certainly gives you an automorphism of Q bar. And the condition that it fixes Q is automatic, because, I mean, that's no condition at all. So any automorphism of QP bar over QP gives you an automorphism of Q bar. And that gives you a map from here to there. Now the question is, why is it injective? And that's because these automorphisms are continuous, so they're determined on the Q bar state inside of QP bar. This Q bar is dense inside of QP bar, so it determines all the automorphisms. That's why this is injective. So that's why. You get a map like this, but it's only, just to be a little careful, it's only after choosing an embedding of Q bar into QP bar. And you have to do that one for each prime P. But you can prove that the kernel here doesn't depend on what choice you make. So this is really well defined. So that's what the Shafirovich Tate group is. It's a group, and what it tells you is that if you have two elements in here and you want to understand something about them, and you take them and you understand something about them locally, so you want to prove they're equal for some reason. If you prove they're equal locally at each prime P, and that's usually a pretty easy thing to do if it's true, since you really have a lot of control over this, then their difference is in here. So if this were zero, then you know that they're actually equal. But some like group that it's an obstruction to being able to work purely locally and get everything you need. Like if you look at algebra, just commutative algebra, for example, you'll find that tons of the proofs involve reducing to the local case using some sort of localization, for example. And that happens all the time in mathematics. So it's good to measure how, you know, bad the failure is. The standard conjecture here is that this group is finite, which is implicit in the statement of the conjecture over there. So the conjecture, this is finite. And this is known for curves of rank 0 or 1. So in this context, Shah is finite. But it's not known for any curve of rank 2 or greater, not a single one. But you should still think of it as being very small. Okay, so that's the Shafravitch take group. So now you've seen a definition of each of the quantities in this conjecture. And I think the most mysterious one's got to be the Shafravitch take group, given that it's very difficult to prove that it's finite. And for curves of rank greater than or equal to 2, nobody succeeded in even a single case. Whereas you can compute all the other quantities appearing there, in practice at least, to whatever precision you want, without too much difficulty. Though computing the regulator, in general, we don't know how to do it, because in order to do it, you have to compute the Mortel-A group. And there's no algorithm that we can prove works to compute the Mortel-A group. There's an algorithm that works, but we just can't prove it yet. In fact, if you can prove that Sha is finite for an elliptic curve, then you know for a fact that the conjectural algorithm for computing Mortel-A groups will actually terminate on that particular curve. There's a connection there, but I won't go into it. So here's a motivating problem. Take the book that is back there, and then try to prove the formula for every single curve in that book. Right? Because Cremona didn't do it when he wrote the book, and nobody's done it, and maybe it's pretty hard. So so when I say for specific curves, I mean every curve in that book back there. It's a pretty thick book, but you can try. So let's see, these are just some techniques that you would use. Should I go back here? So that's the goal, to prove the conjecture, the exact formula for every curve in that book. And what this requires you to do is to figure out what is known about the conjecture. What are the precise statements? In other words, it's asking it's answering your question. Okay, so try to answer your question for one curve at a time, for every curve in that book. You know, get the exact formula. So that's the goal here. And so what can you do? So I'll tell you kind of what the status is. So this is just the general status of the conjecture in general. So when the order of vanishing is less than or equal to 3, at least you can compute the analytic rank, that is the order of vanishing of the L function. If you look through that curve, every curve in there has order of vanishing of its L function less than or equal to 2. So you can verify that the order of vanishing of the L function does equal the rank of the curve, and Cremona has done that already. Computing these invariants is relatively easy. Computing the regulator has already been done for all the curves in that book. Computing the order of Sha, though, is very, very difficult, and it has not been done for the curves in that book. There is a theorem of Kaliwagen, which says that if the order of vanishing is less than or equal to 1, well, first, Sha is finite. Moreover, there's an explicit bound on the order of Sha, an upper bound, a multiple of the order of Sha. And the multiple comes from these Huebner points. A certain explicit computation that one can do, and hopefully Crane has been doing lately, she's done this in a lot of cases, of a Huebner point on an elliptic curve that you plug into a certain formula, essentially, and it gives you an explicit multiple of the order of the Shafravitch take group. So you compute this multiple for every curve in that book. Sometimes the computation can take a while, but you do it, hopefully. And in many cases, you get that the multiple is 1. And then you're done, because you've proven that the order of Sha is an integer, and if it divides 1, then it has to be trivial. But there are many cases where you don't get that, and then you have to work harder. By the way, here's Kaliwagen. So his theorem is, of course, very important to this, which gives a bound on the order of Sha. Maybe I'll just, I can almost state it precisely without telling you too much. So you have your elliptic curve E. You have the curve X naught of N that maps to it. There, you take a certain collection of points here coming from a certain quadratic imaginary field. You get a point YK So you do this for a quadratic imaginary field q returning root minus d, or sorry, q returning root d. You get a point yk, and it's on the elliptic curve over k. And then what you do is you consider the index in e of k of the group generated by yk. And when this point yk is not a torsion point, this has finite index. And that index squared times possibly some other primes that you have to throw out because you have, for example, p torsion or something. This is a multiple of the order of Shaw of p. So it's something like that. In fact, this is correct because I haven't told you what the star is exactly. So star is 2 times the primes where the if you take the field q adjoin ep, where p is a prime, so q adjoin all the p torsion of e, that field has degrees strictly less than the cardinality of GL2FP. That is to say, the mod p Galois representation is not surjective. You throw away those primes, you throw away 2, those are the primes you include here, some arbitrarily large power, then you get that Shaw of e divides that. And that is that's the theorem that Kleiwegen proved. And the only thing I haven't told you is exactly how to construct y sub k. But, yes, please. So this is a finite, so one hypothesis is that this is finite. If yk is a torsion point, just declare this index to be 0, and then the divisibility says nothing, everything divides 0. Okay? But it is a theorem that if yk has infinite order, then e of k will have rank 1, and hence this index will be finite.
In which case you
order
Shaw?
Yes, that's right. And that's how he proves this. He says that if the order of vanishing is less than or equal, then the Shaw is finite. Not only is it finite, it divides this explicitly given thing times these things that you can control. And, so Karina's doing her project, I hope, on some weak version of the statement that Shaw divides something like this. So it's written up in several locations. So let me tell you a little about Cremona's book. So that book has, again, all the curves of conductor up to 1,000. And he's actually extended the book online. Now, remember at the beginning of the course, I think I said 30,000, maybe 29,000. So now it's at 40,000. It's on his webpage. He's listed every curve up to conductor 40,000. And in fact, he's gone up to 43,000, but he hasn't put those on his webpage yet. But for every curve where he does, where he finds the curves, he also verifies that the rank conjecture is true for that curve. And the reason that he's going so rapidly suddenly is that he suddenly has access to a very nice cluster of computers, which he's never had access to before. So in his computations, he computes every quantity occurring in the conjecture except cardinality of Shaw. He computes them all to high precision. So in each case, you can solve for the order of Shaw and see what you get. And then the challenge is to prove that the order of Shaw is the number that you get. So if you look at Cremona's book, which is right over there, I don't know if that edition has... I think this is referring to the second edition. That's the first one. But there he says that for the optimal curves, so in each isogeny class, there's one curve that you can single out. Yes, please.
Provably computing the rank, or just...
Yes, he's provably computing the rank. So there's no proof that the procedure we use to compute the rank will always terminate. But if it does terminate, it terminates and correctly provably computes the rank.
Does he provably compute the order of vanishing?
Yes. You can provably compute the order of vanishing as long as it's less than or equal to 3. Though no one's ever provably computed an order of vanishing that's bigger than 3. That's an open problem. To give any order of vanishing greater than or equal to 4 is an open problem. But if you could do that, then you would get a much better bound for effectively finding all quadratic imaginary fields of given class number, strangely enough. So in the range of his computations, he's never found a curve of rank 4. The smallest conductor of a curve of rank 4 that we know is 234,446. And there might be one of smaller conductor. Once he gets up to 234,446, then we'll know that that's the smallest one, unless he finds one before then. So. I did a project with a couple of, with Andre Jorza, who's not here, and Jen Balakrishnan, where we verified that the first conductor of a curve of rank 4 is composite. That is, we found all the curves of rank, well, we showed there were no curves of rank 4 in prime conductor up to that number that I just gave you, that composite number I just gave you. Therefore, the first one, whatever it is, if Kremona keeps calculating and he finally finds a curve of rank 4, that curve will have composite conductor. That's all we know. We don't know what conductor it will be. The significance of that is that the first known curves of rank 0, 1, 2, and 3 are all of prime conductor, 11, 37, 389, and 5077. Okay, so if you if you look at the book, the curves are grouped into little clumps. So maybe you can pull up the book or toss it to me. You look at the tables near the end. The cover. See, they're grouped into little clumps separated by dashes. Those are isogeny classes of Lipschitz curves. So you take one curve and then you can map via a homomorphism of finite degree possibly to another curve, and you say two curves are isogenous if there's a homomorphism of finite degree from one to the other. It'll automatically be surjective. So you group them into isogeny classes. To prove the Bertrand Sorrentin-Dyer formula for one curve in the isogeny class is equivalent to proving it for any other curve in the isogeny class. And that was Andre Jorza's senior thesis that he just did, that statement. He wrote up Castle's proof of this and Tate's generalization of it. So you just need to prove it, say, for the first one. Now, it turns out, in this whole book, there are only four curves for which the first curve is conjectured to have non-trivial Shaw. In all other cases, and there are over 2,400 other cases, in all other cases, the first curve is conjectured to have trivial Shaw. So really, to prove that the BSD formula is true for every curve in this book, all you have to do is prove that, except in four cases, Shaw is trivial. That's the problem. And in four cases, you have to prove it's not trivial, but you have to prove it has a certain order. So here's a picture of John Cremona, by the way. And here is a list of the four curves for which the conjectural order of Shaw is not 1. In all other cases, if you look at the first curve in each isogeny class, the conjectural order of Shaw is trivial. It should just be 1. So for each of these, you can prove that Shaw does have the conjectured order. Each curve here has rank 0, rank less than or equal to 1. You get a bound like this, and you can also use some other techniques to deal with p equals 2, and you get that the order is exactly as indicated. Okay? So now you're left with all the other curves. So this was about showing that the order is exactly as indicated, but I'll skip it because it's kind of technical. Now you're left with all other curves. So unfortunately, there are 18 classes where there's a curve where the curve has rank 2. And there, nobody has shown that Shaw is finite for any of them. We don't even know in one case that Shaw is finite. So for those, it's going to be pretty difficult to show that Shaw has order 1. So you can either completely give up, or you can maybe try to show that there's no P torsion in Shaw for all P up to 100. You could do something like that. But really, these 18 are complete stumpers for everybody right now. So you forget about those. Okay, you fail. You're not going to be able to prove the full BSD conjecture for every curve in this book because of these annoying 18 curves of rank 2. Since for none of them can you even prove so far using any ideas that are currently out there, even conjecturally, nobody has a good way to prove that Shaw is finite for those 18 curves. It's very frustrating. But you can sort of calm down and not worry about those 18 curves. Get on with life. Realize that this project, even if you can't prove the full conjecture for every last curve in there, could still be very useful because you find all kinds of amazing examples along the way. So, okay, so there are 2,463 curves that are optimal. 18 of them have rank 2. Throw those away. We're not going to be able to deal with them. So you have 2,445 curves, and there were 4 of them that had non-trivial Shaw, and in each of those cases use an argument involving a bound like this and some other things, and you get that Shaw's exactly has the order that's indicated. So you have 2,441 curves left. For every single one of those, you want to prove that the order of Shaw is 1. If you could do that, then you would prove the formula for every curve in this book except for the 18 curves of rank 2. So that's the goal. So first you turn this formula into an algorithm and try to refine how sort of bad this is. The assumption in Kolyvagin's work is that that Q adjoined DP, this field over Q, has Galois group equal to GL2FP, isomorphic to GL2FP, which is a pretty strong assumption. It would be nice to have something weaker. There's a guy, Bunyoung Cha, who Johns Hopkins, who proved that all you need is that the Galois group is it's irreducible as a subgroup of this. That is the natural two-dimensional representation of your subgroup on FP cross FP is irreducible. And this summer, Stefan Petrikas refined that result somewhat and got something where, well, it's another criterion that's maybe a little weaker than irreducible. I'm not sure if I found any examples where it is weaker, but there's a slightly better way there's a slightly better version of this. So you improve things there, and then you do the computation, and you get, for each curve, you get an explicit multiple of the order of Sha, of the order of the Sha-Ferrer-Jeter group. Whenever that multiple is 1, you're done. You've proved that Sha is trivial, as you wanted. When it's not 1, well, you can at least look at the primes that appear, and if there's some simple way of describing them, at least you can make a clean statement, such as the following. For every curve in this book, and for every prime P, where P doesn't divide the order of the torsion subgroup of the elliptic curve, or any Tamagawa number of the elliptic curve, then the P part of the order of Sha is trivial, or at least is as given by the BSD formula. So that's sort of the ultimate goal of this project, to say that if you avoid certain bad primes that somehow are forced to occur here, to appear here, then, and that you can describe in a simple way, then you have that the BSD conjecture is true. So the goal of this, in the end, which will hopefully be in the next week, is, this is the goal. Or theorem, because it's not done yet, but, well, because it's not precisely stated either. If EP is a pair, an elliptic curve E over Q has conductor less than or equal to 1,000, has rank 0 or 1, P doesn't divide any of the Tamagawa numbers for the elliptic curve, doesn't divide the cardinality of the torsion subgroup. The representation is some condition on the representation, like irreducible. So I'll just write this one. P doesn't divide this, and AP irreducible. That's just the statement I made over here, that this is irreducible. This should imply then the order of Sha P infinity, that is the P part of this order, is equal to the conjectural order. Now, if you directly apply this formula, you don't quite get this. There are, you know, maybe 20, 30, or 40 exceptions where it doesn't work. And then in each case, you can try to do something extra and end up with exactly this statement. And that's what we're aiming for in this paper. So this is not a theorem, but it's a conjecture. But I hope it'll be a theorem within a week. But, So there's a problem. These Tamagawa numbers always divide this index. And so whenever you have these Tamagawa numbers, you can't bound the order of Sha like you'd like to do. But there are some other, there's a theorem of Kuzio Kato for rank 0 elliptic curves, which replaces this by something slightly better, but only for primes greater than or equal to 5. And if you apply that, then you get around this problem with the Tamagawa numbers. You get something without this condition for rank 0 curves and P greater than or equal to 5. But for rank 1, this Tamagawa number seems to we don't really know any good way of getting around that. Though there's a completely different strategy that doesn't involve Euler, doesn't involve Colley-Weigand's work or Kato's work, but ideas about p-adic L functions attached to elliptic curves that were introduced by Maser long ago and have been developed over the years that should deal with this. Okay, so I think that I'll stop 5 minutes early. I don't think there's really much more to say here except just bound. So anyways, I've taken you from the basics of algebraic number theory to elliptic curves, and then today giving you some sense of the forefront of research in the arithmetic of elliptic curves. So I hope you enjoyed the journey and have a fun future. And I just say a word about your project. So join the U-team. I have office hours today, and you should send me a draft next Thursday for comment. Okay, so thank you very much. You can send me drafts, whatever.
In addition, I'll always try to talk about this.
I slept through high school. I always stayed up really, really late and got up really early because I would just like work on my computer until 5 in the morning programming or something. Then I'd get up at 8 for school, and then I would sleep all day in school. It was awful.
Well, in my case, my parents always gave me the, like, what do you possibly